Hello and welcome to the Arms Control Poser Podcast. My name is William Albrecht, Director of Strategy, Technology, and Arms Control at the International Institute for Strategic Studies in Berlin. I will be your host as we explore the world of arms control. On each podcast, I will interview the great and the good of the arms control community about a current event related to a treaty or agreement, past, present, or only proposed. Then together, we will go, hopefully, deep enough on the history and functioning of the agreement to help you make sense of it all. And, well, that's the idea anyway. This podcast is funded by the European Union Non-Proliferation and Disarmament Consortium. Now let's get underway. Welcome to the Arms Control Poser Podcast. My name is William Alberg. And today I have a special guest, Mara Zarka, the Research Associate and Project Manager at the Vienna Center for Disarmament and Non-Proliferation. And we are also joined by Louis Reitman, Research Associate at the VCDNP, and Federica Dall'Arca, a Senior Research Associate at the Vienna Center. Welcome, everybody.
Thank you, William. Thank you for inviting us.
Hello. Thanks for
the invitation. Thank you, William.
Good to be with you.
And today's topic we're going to talk about is representation in arms control and disarmament from the policymaker to the practitioner. So, Mara, can you tell me a little bit of the history of women in arms control and representation through time in the disarmament field?
Absolutely, William. And I think it's really important to start with the history because women have been engaged in disarmament efforts dating as far back as the early 1900s. And you see this with the formation of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom that was formed in 1915. So what happened at that moment was that a group of women, almost 1,200 women, advocated for the end of World War I and for international disarmament. What's interesting as well is that the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom still exists today, which is incredible. So it basically predates the United Nations, and it also outlived the League of Nations. And today they remain active in the disarmament field, and their disarmament program is Reaching Critical Will, which many of our listeners might be familiar with. But aside from the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, there are several examples of women's engagement in history in matters of nuclear disarmament. And one of the ones that is really striking for me is the Greenham Common protests. So these protests lasted for 19 years, from 1981 to 2000, at the Greenham Common military base in the United Kingdom. And what happened is you saw protesters coming together to challenge the government's plan to place 96 cruise missiles on the base. They set up camp at the base, decorating the fence with family photos and messages stating why they wanted to prevent war, and some even chained themselves to the fence of the base, demanding that a dialogue on disarmament occur. These efforts eventually saw the conclusion of the U.S.-Soviet Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty in 1987, and it also led to the emptying of the nuclear silos at the Greenham Common military base. I had the chance to speak to Rebecca Johnson, and she provided a personal testimony of her 5 years spent at what became known as the Women's Peace Camp. And that was just a really moving and impactful story for me. For our listeners, you can actually read her entire testimony on the EU Nonproliferation Disarmament Consortium's e-learning modules, in particular the one on gender and disarmament. But it is a very impactful firsthand account. But there have been several other movements. I learn about new ones all the time as well, because unfortunately they're not as advertised. But maybe just to finish off here, I'll give one more example that I find to be really impressive. And that is in November of 1961, about 50,000 women, so just the pure size is quite impressive in itself, gathered in 60 U.S. cities around the slogan, "End the arms race, not the human race." This kind of sparked the Women's Strike for Peace movement. And they gathered together to address the threat of nuclear war, but also to speak out against the atmospheric nuclear tests and the harms of radioactive fallout, which I know will likely be discussed in a future podcast. But 2 years after this movement was formed, you saw the Limited Test Ban Treaty was signed, and that banned nuclear tests in the atmosphere, outer space, and underwater. So these efforts have been really impactful, and I think one of the downsides is that they're not as well known, even despite how impactful they have been and the treaties they have led to.
To be a little bit cynical, I mean, on the one hand, I do think pressure in the U.S. for disarmament has been constant throughout the Cold War and was useful in keeping the topic on the top of dialogue. But, you know, when you think of the Commons protest,
You could argue that the Soviets came to the table because of those missile deployments. And it didn't fundamentally change either the NATO deployments or the UK deployment of nuclear weapons, which continues. I mean, I saw recently people saying that they were going to revive those protests because there's talk that they're going to put tactical nuclear weapons in the NATO B-61s in the UK, which again seems a little bit weird because the UK already has its own nuclear weapons. So is there the possibility here that we're looking at a protest that, number one, might not be as impactful on the INF treaty as we estimate, and number two, might actually have been putting pressure on the NATO allies not to do the one thing that actually got the Russians to the table. I mean, the Soviets weren't looking at those women's protests and saying, oh no, we better disarm. They were saying, oh good, the West is under pressure from itself to not do things. Do you know what I mean? So on the one hand, it's great to see people engaging, but on the other hand, isn't there the risk that in democracies we put ourselves under pressure, whereas there's no concomitant pressure on, say, Russia or China or North Korea in that regard?
I, as an international relations scholar, would say, I mean, if you look at typical IR theory, there's the different theories of camp that you test in your different hypotheses and your different research questions. And I know for me in particular, when I was looking at the shift in India's foreign policy for my undergraduate thesis, two of the main things that led to India's shift in foreign policy was domestic pressure and threat perception. So I don't think we can undermine the impact domestic pressure can have, whether that's in a democratic society or an autocratic one. And I think that's exactly what these women movements accomplished, is putting pressure on the governments in questioning the policies that they are using, in most cases, tax dollar money to implement.
No, I mean, I completely understand that, But you know, again, I would say that, you know, the INF crisis, you know, putting the UK under pressure did not, I don't think anyone would say that putting the UK under pressure substantially changed either the US or Soviet negotiating position here. Do you know what I mean? I get it. That just particular example always struck me as something where engagement is good, but putting pressure where the pressure matters also counts, if you know what I mean, because Margaret Thatcher certainly didn't change her positions whatsoever, and in fact, she, you know, had very bad things to say about those protests. But I don't know. I guess you know, and the India example, I wouldn't say that India's nuclear posture has changed. What particular change in their foreign policy were you talking about?
So when I was looking at this for my undergraduate thesis, which is a bit of a derail from our current podcast topic, but yeah. I was actually looking at how India is one of the nations that proposed a treaty on the non-proliferation of nuclear weapons. And they really thought that such a treaty would be concluded, and then at the end of the day, ended up not signing it, and shortly thereafter also testing nuclear weapons. So that was a dramatic shift. And it was a very interesting research project. But like I said, I know that's not entirely the topic of our current podcast.
Okay, well, can you tell me a little bit in terms of the participation of women today? Is there anything happening in the United Nations history that got women more engaged in the UN dialogue or instruments on arms control, disarmament, non-proliferation?
Absolutely. The UN has been doing quite a bit that started in the 70s, I would say. The 70s was kind of a pinnacle year for the United Nations when they started engaging with emancipation of women and looking at different measurements and different things they could do to forward that agenda item. And one of the big things you saw there was the first UN conference on women that was held in Mexico City in 1975. And 1975 is also the year that the UN General Assembly claimed to be International Women's Year. So the UN World Conference on Women kind of snowballed a lot of other actions that took place. You saw in 1977, the 8th of March was adopted by the United Nations as the International Women's Day. And in 1979, you saw the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, the CEDAW, was adopted also under the UN General Assembly, and it stressed the importance of women's participation and leadership in all policy areas, including disarmament. What happened from there is that three subsequent UN World Conferences on Women took place. You had Copenhagen in 1980, Nairobi in 1985, and Beijing in 1995. And the 1995 conference was where they adopted what is known as the Beijing Declaration, Platform for Action. It covers 12 critical areas of concern, which includes women in power and decision-making, women in armed conflict, and education and training of women. The Beijing conference was followed by a series of 5 years review, and they have a big review coming up in 2025, which will be the 30th anniversary. So it will be an interesting year to look at to kind of assess how the Beijing Declaration is being implemented. But just speaking of this, if you go from the first conference in 1975 to the Beijing conference in 1995, in 1975, you had 133 member states taking place and 6,000 civil society participants. Whereas in 1995, you had that jump to 189 member states and over 30,000 civil society participants. So you saw a big momentum around this. And I mentioned these two critical areas because when you look at these issues, it is often considered the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. I know it's a long title. And the Beijing Platform for Action, they're considered the key global reference points for gender and equality policy and also kind of serve as the international community's roadmaps to promoting empowerment and rights of women and girls around the world. So when you're looking at what the UN's doing and also what member states are doing, especially as they're adopting national action plans, these are kind of used as the reference point. And then, of course, the other huge hallmark resolution was the UN Security Council Resolution 1325, was adopted unanimously in 2000, and it was the very first time that a UN Security Council resolution recognized the different impact armed conflict had on women and girls compared to men and boys, women's role in preventing and resolving conflict. It called for equal participation in security and peacemaking efforts, and it encouraged a gender component be included in all peacekeeping operations. So UNSCR 1325 was a collaboration between civil society, the UN, and governments, and it kind of built the momentum to recognize that systemic and structured engagement of women in peace and security matters should be standard practice. What happened after UNSCR 1325 is that six subsequent resolutions were adopted between the years of 2008 and 2016. And UNSCR 1325 plus the six subsequent resolutions are what make up what is now called the Women, Peace, and Security Agenda. And so what has happened since then is that the UN First Committee that focuses on disarmament has committed itself since the year 2010 to adopt a resolution on women, peace, and security at least every 2 years. And so you saw the first resolution adopted in 2010, the most recent one adopted in 2022. And throughout this entire period that they've been adopting resolutions, one thing that is always added to the resolutions is the need for member states to promote equal opportunities for the representation of women in all decision-making processes with regard to matters related to disarmament, non-proliferation, and arms control. So this commitment by the First Committee keeps the conversation going, it keeps the topic present, and it also allows for an assessment to see how the international community is doing, to see how individual member states are doing in making sure that peace and security processes include gender perspectives and that gender mainstream is taking place in these policies.
Well, and so there's an area where we can actually use data to figure out whether there's a gap and what the gap is. Can you tell me, do we have data on whether there's a gender gap in arms control, disarmament, non-proliferation? And if so, what characterizes it?
Yeah, absolutely. So UNIDIR, the UN Institute for Disarmament Research, has done a lot of really great work on collecting this type of data. It's really great that they're doing this. Also Reaching Critical Will, kind of this, the disarmament branch of the Women's International League for Peace, also does a lot of work on this. But one of the UNIDIR surveys, they surveyed at least 80 multilateral meetings in the diplomatic field, and they found that most international disarmament conferences, that only 1/3 of the delegates were women, and even fewer were heads of delegation. So what you see is that women tend to specifically be underrepresented in small forums as well, especially when states can only send one representative. So what UNIDIR found in one of their studies, for example, is that at smaller forums, which they classified as forums with less than 100 people, the proportion of women dropped to just 20%. And in larger forums, it increased slightly to about 32%. These numbers are from 2018. You are seeing a greater focus on gender, I think, in disarmament for and nowadays, at least more people are speaking about gender. but you still see that the numbers are significantly below 50%. So we are far away from gender parity. Mm-hmm. Another trend that has been noticed in the data, which I find really interesting, is that when you look at the proportion of heads of delegate compared to the overall number of delegates present, it varies significantly if you're looking at men or women. So again, taking figures from 2018, for example, what you saw is that 76% of heads of delegations at disarmament meetings were men, which was above the 66% overall proportion of men delegates that were present. And when you look at the same statistic for women, you see that they are significantly underrepresented in leadership positions compared to what would be expected in the overall proportion of women delegates present at a given meeting. And one thing when we talk about these statistics that I find really interesting and where a lot of improvement is needed is when you look at the UN First Committee. It has only had one woman chair in its entire 78 sessions so far.
Ooh.
And that was in 2006. A bit of good news. I understand that the next chair might be a woman, which would improve the statistics slightly, but only very slightly. So this really shows we still have a ways to go. And I know my colleague Federica also has a lot of facts and figures at the ready, so I'm happy to turn to her to really identify further.
Sure,
gaps.
Thanks so much, Mara. Yeah, there are definitely the number of women in decision-making processes and in arms control, non-proliferation, and disarmament negotiations, as you correctly stated, is extremely low. On average, only 32% of the delegates participating in arms control, non-proliferation, and disarmament negotiating fora are women. And the number drops significantly when we look at heads of delegations, as you mentioned, or smaller forums like groups of governmental experts. The number goes down to 20%. The situation is not much better if we look at other numbers. For instance, in the United Nations, only 21% of senior and decision-making positions, we're talking P5 level and above, are covered by women. And only 3% of the military in the United Nations missions, the so-called blue helmets, are women. And what's even more concerning, I would say, that the majority of these 3% are just supporting staff positions, so administrative. So we really don't have women on the ground, which is concerning. We could even take it a step further, and we can say that only 35% of all diplomats around the world are women, 21.6% of all ambassadors are women. So just to give you the precise number, 927 ambassadors out of 4,293, which is a very concerning number, I would say. Yeah, there's so much to say about this, so I will give you the mic back to you.
These are very hard things to get at. It's very easy to vote unanimously for a resolution, but it's much harder to address this systemically. And I mean, when I think about this, when you, for instance, Federico, just bringing up how many blue helmets there are, how many militaries around the world allow women into combat positions? And, you know, that gets at a huge issue in terms of arms control, where you count the number of countries that actually have female arms control inspectors. And again, that reflects the military. So, you know, the US is very good at this, but other countries that just don't have roles for women in the military and don't have the promotion potential and don't have the access to higher echelons, it becomes a big issue. Federica?
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you on this, William. What's fun is that, for instance, if we look at one of the most recent conflicts that we are experiencing right now, the conflict, the Russian invasion in Ukraine, certain military positions in Ukraine were not even open to women before the outbreak of the war. And this is very problematic, and but this is not something new. Before the Second World War, for instance, a lot of positions and a lot of things for women were not available, and they only became available when there was a concrete need for people. And so then women were good enough to, then become soldiers. And so what's really important, for instance, in the context of Ukraine, we're now seeing that paradoxically there is a you know, an opening towards women covering more important positions, but it's going to be important to see that this availability to open access is going to be kept after the end of the war.
Well, and so, Mara, you know, what do you think? So considering there really are countries, I mean, I recall I was having a NATO WMD conference and I wanted to have a panel on the P5. And of course, you know, you ask the countries to send someone, and each country was kind enough to send the actual ambassador in charge of the NPT negotiations, and they were all men. And, you know, here I have a commitment not to have mammals. And so at the last second, I actually gave that panel up and gave it to my deputy, a woman, to run the panel just to prevent it from being all men. But I mean, this is like a systemic issue. How do we address this? How do you get more countries to go beyond paying lip service to there has to be representation to actually putting women in important diplomatic positions, in important military positions, and thus giving them access to the implementation and decision-making in arms control?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is based on the leadership in a particular government, department, and the roles that people carry. A lot of this deals with political will, at least at the outset, until it becomes more institutionalized that this is just common practice. And one thing that has taken off is the International Gender Champions Initiative. You talked about Manos just now, and like one of their main commitments, if these heads of delegations are committing themselves to be an international gender champion, is that you shouldn't have single-sex panels. And all gender champions have to take that commitment, in addition to taking other commitments to try to improve gender parity, either externally or internally. And I think initiatives like that are a start. And it's important that you do have those leaders that are willing to sign on to that type of initiative, willing to openly say, I commit to not have single-sex panels. I commit to these other goals. I commit to making sure my advisory board is 50-50 parity. I think openly stating your commitments and then having observers hold you accountable is a starting point to try to see these changes. Because as you said, a lot of it is systemic, and there are a lot of resources out there, though, to try to tackle this systemic challenge. I mean, just going back to Manos, one quote that I found really interesting from Heather Grab, she gave this quote when she was the director of the Open Society European Policy Institute. She said, "Women have to have more credentials than men. They have to have more qualifications, a higher status position, and usually be later in their career to be asked to speak on a hard security topic. And they have to prove the value of their words and views, whereas their male counterparts are assumed to know what they are talking about from the start." And I have to say, this is completely true. Is it fair? No, probably not. But we do have things in place to try to combat this. So not only the Gender Champion Initiative, but another thing that I haven't tried myself, but I'd be really curious to try, is Women at the Table developed what they call a gender gap app. And what this application is supposed to do is supposed to actually measure the amount of speaking time of women and the topics of discussion. So you're not just measuring how many women are in the room, but who is getting to speak and who is getting heard. So are the women just filling chairs, or are they actually actively participating? And a lot of the initiatives we've already mentioned, it is about active and meaningful participation of women. And I think that's a really important point. A final thing that I'll say, a lot of people have different opinions about quotas, but I do think quotas work as a first step. I know some people criticize quotas because it's just like a checking off of the box. Oh, I need X amount of women in my department. Check. Yes, it can be that way, but it at least gets the conversation started. It at least gets more women in the room. It at least has more women present and more women visible to then kind of push through these barriers. So just going out there saying quotas, they're not perfect, but it's at least a good first step.
This is a good place to take a pause. You've been listening to William Alberg on the Arms Control Poser podcast. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation with Mara Zarka. We'll be back in just a minute.
I think you're absolutely correct. I mean, when I first came into my position at NATO and started to organize sessions and panels and things like that, I would look at previous conferences and be like, okay, who was really good? And then I realized, well, that's only going to create an echo chamber. And so instead, I instructed my staff to find young voices, diverse voices, new voices, and give them the chance at the panel. And this is one thing that, about quotas, that always makes me laugh. People say, well, then, you know, you're going to have your token woman on the panel. And it's like, okay, but I've been working in this field long enough that sometimes I can look at a panel and be like, I can tell you why that guy is totally incompetent and is only on that panel because he's friends with that guy. Or I can tell you why that guy is going to say the same damn thing he said at every panel for the past 15 years. You know what I mean? There is tokenism within the male community too. So I love the idea of giving a new voice an opportunity and seeing what happens, because hell, often I know what's going to happen if I pick the same old guy that I've always picked for every panel ever. Federico.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic, William. And I wish all participants and conferences organizers were thinking exactly like you. But you mentioned a word that I think it's very important, and it's the word systemic. This is a systemic problem. And we need to address the root causes of the problem, which are stereotypes. There's still the stereotype whereby women are not interested in defense, they're not interested in security. And so if I have to pick a speaker for a conference, why would I pick a woman? Because she probably doesn't know what she's talking about, as Mara said. There's this perception of futility again, that it doesn't matter if it's a man. We talked about this a little bit during the podcast with Louis. But, you know, there's this perception of futility that at the end of the day, especially in the case of multilateral fora or in the UN context, delegates are just messengers of the capitals. And so it doesn't really matter who's delivering the message. At the end of the day, it's important to deliver the message of the capital. But then my question to you is, if women are not in those decision-making positions, who is shaping the message in the capital, you know? And so... but then there are other reasons, the lack of field-specific education, lack of role models. So, for instance, a woman that enters the career or enters the arms control and proliferation and disarmament career path might find herself unsure in terms of potential next steps, because there's no representation or there's no role models. So there's this automatic thinking that, okay, maybe there's no more space for me going up in the ladder, you know? And obviously the fact that there are family policies at the national and international levels that are really not helping women to maintain a career. And I know Mara has a lot to say about these stereotypes as well and these root causes of the problem that needs to be addressed. So I'll give back the mic.
Yeah, no, thank you very much, Federica. Just on the point about work-life balance for women in the field, I think this is really interesting because Federica's already talked about there's mentorship programs to try to help young people become interested in the field of arms control, non-proliferation, disarmament. And I think there has been a growing number of mentorship programs being created for this exact purpose. The VCDNP, along with the International Affairs Institute in Rome, have developed such a mentorship program under the EU Non-Proliferation and Disarmament Consortium to try to get young women engaged in the field. And I think you would say their numbers might be improving in that regard. But the real hook for me, or the real interesting data that I feel like we don't have enough of, is why do women leave the field? What is that point in their career where they decide they want to pursue something else? What actually pushes them away from the field? And how could we retain them, more importantly then? And as Federica said, I mean, if you look at this is all just subjective at the moment. We really need the data, but is it due to a lack of promotion opportunities? Is it because they're worn out and tired of being that one woman always called on to be on a panel? Is it because the field isn't actually very accommodating for family life? I mean, you talk about people being really proud they stayed till 4 a.m. at a particular meeting. I mean, if you have a small kid at home, that's not really feasible to do. But I think what would be really interesting, we're focusing a lot right now, or a lot of organizations are focusing right now on how to get women into the field. But even more importantly, how do we retain women in the field? And why are women feeling the need to leave the field at some point in their career? I know the idea has come up about having mentorship programs for mid-career women. And I actually think that's a really interesting idea, because that's the point where you're established, but maybe you're lacking the upward movement, or you're established, or maybe you took some time off because you started a family and then you're finding it hard to come back into the field. So I think looking at retention is really a goal that we should be focused on. I could say more on stereotypes as well, but maybe I'll have you come in here, William, if there was something you wanted to add to these particular points.
Well, no, I mean, it's interesting because as an American, I have been impressed and pleased at the number and quality of women who've come through arms control. And, you know, you look at people like Rose Gottemuller, Rebecca Herzman, you know, all these extraordinary women. I wonder if I absolutely believe that retention is important and finding ways to keep women in career fields is a critical thing. It's especially a big issue in militaries. But I mean, to me, in this field, we're talking about how in the United States and Europe, where we've done really well at getting women involved, we can retain women. Cool. How can we get other continents to go from zero to one? To me, that's a much bigger question. I would love to have Rose. I mean, I think Rose is doing a great job at mentoring younger people. I think Rebecca, former head of CSIS Pony, now headed by Heather Williams, is doing amazing things like what Women in International Security. There are lots of tools I see out there to keep women or to attract women in Europe and the United States. But really, what do you do in Asia? What do you do in the Middle East? What do you do in Africa? What do you do in places where there is simply no route in?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think some of it also stems, I think Federica had mentioned this very briefly, also on educational opportunities. I mean, it is sometimes difficult to find courses on this particular subject matter. And even more so, there's a lot of people that say the interconnectedness of the world sometimes prevents young people from wanting to actually specialize in a field. And the arms control, non-proliferation, disarmament field often does require a certain degree of specialization. And I bring this up just because there is a lot of faith in the youth right now. The younger generation is extremely active and speaking out about what they care about. But there also is research that shows that the younger generation, they have a shorter attention span, and they are less of specialists and more of generalists, which is not a problem per se, but it also could be difficult to kind of keep people in the field as well. And so when you're looking at places that are having a problem just kind of getting people in the door, I think education is a really good starting point in the first instance. And also recognizing, of course, that there's regional differences regarding how disarmament, nonproliferation, and arms control are looked at. I know at the Vienna Center for Disarmament and Nonproliferation, we focus a lot on nuclear, but for a lot of African countries, they're more concerned with small arms and light weapons. So it's really being able to offer the education, but also offer the education that is relevant for a certain region to get them engaged in the field, but also to empower them by realizing they could be part of a change. I think the younger generation is really great at wanting to have a say in their future. And I think it's important to be able to show people that by entering a field, they can also actually make an impact in the field. And yeah, I think that's one of the main messages that needs to bring across. And the immediate thing I always go to, though, in that instance is education, right? Knowledge is power, and that's always a good starting point.
It is a good starting point. I think that is, but it still strikes me as we have so much, there's so many more cultural issues to get at. I mean, I can recall one of my good Chinese colleagues said, no, we're really good on women, peace, and security. For instance, a woman wrote my speaking notes. And I just thought, that's great, but why isn't she here with you then? And then, you know, I was with the Russians once, and they said, look, we have a woman on our delegation. And we all looked and went, oh, wow, look. All the way in the back, huh? But, you know, there was absolutely no opportunity for her to speak, and I've never seen her again. You know what I mean? So it's like, how do we do this? Louis, help us out here.
Yeah, I think you raise an interesting point, and I think there sometimes is a tendency to try to look at others. I think this is sort of this whataboutism problem that a lot of debates generally today suffer from. There's still a whole lot to do in Western countries when it comes to the representation and meaningful inclusion of women in the nonproliferation, disarmament, arms control space. And I think a really good example of this is what is called the nuclear priesthood in the United States. So this is the the policy community of officials that control nuclear strategy, nuclear deterrence, the development of the nuclear arsenal. And there was a fantastic study done in 2019 by the New America Foundation, which interviewed 23 very senior women from the U.S. nuclear weapons space, like Rose Gottemuller, that we already mentioned, Laura Kennedy, Laura Holgate, that kind of caliber of women. And what a lot of them reported is that there's a significant divide between the nuclear priesthood and the arms control and nonproliferation community. And whereas we've seen a whole lot of progress in the latter, women making significant impacts, really leading on arms control efforts, as Rose Gottemuller was the lead negotiator for the US in the New START negotiations. But on the other side, on the nuclear deterrence side, we still see an overwhelmingly white, male, middle-aged crowd. I think if the listeners are familiar with the US STRATCOM deterrence symposium that took place earlier in 2023, there was quite the ripple on social media when pictures from that event were released, and you just saw a sea of middle-aged white men, basically. And if you talk to people who are involved in the nuclear weapons space in the United States, that still very much is the predominant picture. So yes, we need to talk about what we can do globally to improve the representation of women, but there still is a whole lot for us to do in what we might call our own backyard. And I think a very important point that we haven't really touched on yet is that it's not just about representation. It's not just about just adding more female bodies to boardrooms and offices in the relevant places. It's also about changing working cultures and improving working conditions for women in the nuclear space. Some of these things are things that maybe we don't think about, but a lot of this has to do with gender roles and our expectations of how men should behave and how women should behave. And what those senior women from the US nuclear weapons space were reporting in that New America study, which really was kind of paradigm shifting, really broke new ground in how candid and open it was that there are a lot of implicit and explicit expectations of how you're supposed to behave as a woman in the nuclear weapons space. Whereas, you know, there are certain expectations of being focused on technical details, being quite competitive, being overly competent, basically quite masculine, traditionally masculine traits. Things like being an empath, being understanding, being able to listen to different perspectives and take them into account. Skills like community building and communication were heavily discounted. And this is not only a problem for a policy community that is supposed to understand the interests and perspectives of adversaries around the world, right? I mean, that's literally their job to see how the other side is acting and react to that. But it also means that a lot of women feel like they're up against an impossible challenge of being masculine at the same time as not being too masculine, because they eventually, you know, that there also is punishment for acting out of line with societal expectations of how women should behave, of what is considered feminine. So at the end of the day, walking that tightrope has been described by women who've worked on the inside of that as extremely challenging and time consuming. Just really a waste of energy when that energy could have been put to, you know, coming up with fantastic ideas and really working hard on policy. And what ends up happening, and we've touched on the point of retention, is that a lot of women try to compensate by being extremely competent, working extra long hours, being the smartest person in the room, and eventually leave the field because they're burnt out and they understandably are fed up of having to try so hard to earn their place. So I think this is really an area that we need to look at more. It's not just about raising the share of women, but it's also about changing the ways of working in the nuclear weapons space.
I think what Louis brought up is really important, and there's just something I want to add to that. And as Louis already talked about, gender coding is kind of how humans relate actions as being more or less masculine or feminine based on individual or societal value systems. So there, first of all, it could be different depending on what country you're coming from, is another thing that we should highlight. But it's important, as Louis mentioned, it does have an impact on shaping your ideas about politics, weapons, warfare, how you should react in this space. But I think even more important that we should take note of here is that these are social constructs, and they can change over time. It is difficult because they're really ingrained in the systems, especially in the non-proliferation, disarmament, and arms control space, but they can be altered over time. And I think that's what you see, for example, advocates of a feminist foreign policy wanting to do. It's changing the narrative in which we speak about these things. Because as Louis rightfully mentioned, a lot of research shows and demonstrates that participants often find that the non-proliferation, arms control, and disarmament space reward characteristics that are mostly associated with men. And the gendered words also have a huge impact on political actions and even military decisions. There are several examples of this. And if I may, just to carry this point a little further, William, one of the most powerful anecdotes I heard about this was in Carol Cohen's work. And it's from a male physicist who is sitting in a group. Many people might know the strategy, but if you don't, it really is a powerful one that takes this message home. But a male physicist who's sitting in a group of nuclear strategists, and they're putting out different models for counterforce nuclear attacks and trying to calculate realistically how many immediate fatalities there would be if they did X, Y, or Z. And they're sitting around the table and they've decided it would be about 30 million fatalities. And this physicist finally blurts out, wait, I've just heard how we're talking. Only 30 million? Only 30 million human beings killed instantly? And the room falls completely silent. Nobody says a word. And the physicist remarks that they didn't even look at me. It was awful. I felt like a woman. And it's that type of mentality. I mean, when you're talking about strategy, people may not be thinking about other things. And the moment you bring up concern, you automatically get the feminine label. And if I may, just to bring this point one step further, the latest movie, Oppenheimer, I don't know if you've seen it, William. I know the three of us have seen it, and many of our listeners maybe have too. If you recall, after the atomic bomb was dropped in the film, and Oppenheimer goes to the president to express his concerns about this and the need to discuss disarmament and arms control, he's labeled a crybaby. So even in Hollywood, you see this. It's probably also true to what actually maybe occurred. And for those who do follow U.S. politics, even George H.W. Bush struggled with this with the first Gulf War. In the media, he was constantly being seen as too weak and not fit to hold the position of president. And when he finally put in troops in the Gulf War, he was labeled as overcoming his wimp factor. And so I think this just really drives Louis' point home that unfortunately this particular field is dominated by language that a lot of societies perceive as being masculine. And it not only is dominated by that, but those characteristics are often rewarded. And that's why there are efforts now in place to try to change them.
Well, I think that's where we should go because we are running a little bit long. So if you could give me recommendations towards the future, what do we do about this? Specifically, concretely, how do we handle this going forward?
Yeah, I'm really going to ask my colleagues to come in here too. I think we've talked about a couple of things that we can already do, but maybe just to reiterate some of those points, educating people about this and really bringing to the forefront kind of the systems that we learn into, they don't have to stay that way. Recognizing also that power structures and what people refer to as patriarchal structures, they can be changed and they can be shifted. But more importantly, I think accountability. So we talked about quotas. We talked about governments making national action plans. We've talked about the need for political will to bring about these changes, but people also need to be held accountable for those commitments. So at the start of this podcast, we talked about the Beijing Declaration and Platform for Action will be approaching a 30-year mark. UNSCR 1325 will be approaching a 25-year mark. So 2025 would be a good year, if not before, to really sit back and look at the commitments the international community has committed itself to and see how far we've come and look at concrete measures, both on the international, national, local levels that we can work towards to achieve these commitments and also to go about transforming gender norms and value systems and institutional structures.
Okay. Three.
I think a really important point that everybody who wants to advocate for more diversity and specifically more gender inclusion in the nuclear weapons space is that we need to get better at that. I think that sometimes our advocacy for diversity can lack a bit of direction, and we're not really good at communicating to what end we want to pursue diversity. Why is it important to have a diverse group of people think about nuclear weapons and make policy? Because it's not just an end in itself. I mean, of course, there's an inherent value in having a more democratic approach and making decision-making on nuclear weapons accessible to a broader range of people, because nuclear weapons sure don't discriminate about who they kill, if it ever comes to that. But I think we also have to spell out more clearly for everyone why this is actually important for policymaking. This is research that I've been doing for a paper that will be published by UNIDIR early in 2024, where I was trying to look at what psychology and behavioral science say about the value of diversity for human thinking and interaction, policymaking, and policy outcomes, to show that there actually is hard science evidence to say that diversity is good for policymaking and not just for optics. Diversity and gender inclusion are legitimate solutions to policy challenges and not just sort of a nice to have HR policy. And if I can take the example of the nuclear priesthood again, what findings from those studies say is that homogenous groups like the nuclear priesthood are more prone to making systemic fallacies, are more prone to making mistakes and not examining their assumptions and the evidence that they use to base their decisions upon. And if we compare that to the remarkable staying power of traditional deterrence thinking that has seen very, very little intellectual updates since the Cold War, then I think we really need to be asking ourselves, does the homogeneity, the composition of the policy community making these decisions and reproducing those narratives have something to do with that? And I think there is a good amount of evidence to show that it does. And I think as advocates for diversity, we need to get better at connecting those dots between a lack of diversity and poorer quality of policy.
I couldn't agree more. I don't know if you've read the book, but there is actually a book about this by Lynn Eden called World on Fire, where she comes from business studies and she looked at U.S. Strategic Command in the Cold War. And one of the reasons they had over-targeted was because they never took into account fire damage because it was too complex. And the groupthink that just lasted long beyond the point where they actually had the ability to think about this, that homogeneity and that unwillingness to challenge your core beliefs that comes from groupthink, that is built upon the foundation of the same, you know, of a homogeneous decision group, is perfectly illustrated here in the nuclear weapons field. So I strongly recommend that we'll put a link to that book in the comments. Federica, what about you? Do you have thoughts on how to take things forward?
Yeah, sure. Well, first and foremost, I would like to be a little bit provocative here, right? Because Louis said that we need to be a little bit more in explaining why diversity is important. But again, being provocative, if we're talking about women empowerment and women representation in arms control, non-proliferation and disarmament fora, well, women compose 50% of the world population, right? So it is only fair that opportunities that are out there should be open and equally open to everybody. And I think that specifically in this field where there are decision processes or decisions that are influencing the life of so many people, it is not really fair, or it shouldn't be that just one specific group of people is entitled with decisions that impact everyone, right? But I'm just being a bit provocative here. But in terms of things to do, well, I think there are a lot of things that we can do. First and foremost, we should work on dismantle stereotypes. We should bring everyone on board, as we've seen and as we will see in another episode of this podcast. Gender issues do not only impact women, but are issues that are impacting the entire society. Women are an asset, and from an economical point of view, from a political point of view, so they're... integration, their inclusion in decision-making processes is beneficial for everybody. But I think that men also have a specific role in this. This is not just a women fight. And men have a specific responsibility in joining this fight, quote-unquote. When I was in university, there was a reading that was very eye-opening for me. This was a reading an article by Peggy McIntosh. She published it in 1989 and was talking about I don't know if you heard about this, but talking about the invisible backpack of privilege that every white person is carrying on their shoulders. And so she wrote a series of examples on how, there are privileges that are invisible to white people. And so in her article, she was saying that actually the fight against racism is only possible if also white people open their eyes in a way and recognize the privileges that they have. And I think this is could be an interesting parallelism to the issue related to women empowerment and women inclusion or the diversity inclusion in arms control, non-proliferation and disarmament specifically, but in decision-making processes in general. So I think men need to recognize that they are and they have certain positions of privilege. And as you correctly said at the beginning, when you said, you know, that you recognize that in some conferences there were always the same people talking, and then you open the opportunity to younger people. As I said, a lot of people should do like you did. And that's a very good step in recognizing that there is a position of privilege and you actually fight against it. But yeah, we could talk forever about the need of specific education in the field, specific education in, again, gender issues and how, like, even laughing at sexist jokes, you know, can be problematic, and so on and so forth. But I think we would need a completely different podcast for this.
No, I think you're right, and I do think, I mean, this is all a good way forward. And I know, Louis, you called it whataboutism. I do think there's more work to be done in the United States and in Europe. I do think that, but I am worried that we are coming up. Even the education solution, that's great, but something like, what, 60% of the world, 70% of the world is simply not going to provide those opportunities to women. And we're going to have to, you know, how we crack that is, I think, going to be a real challenge moving into the future. I want to see better decision-making, better, more inclusivity. And quite frankly, I think something Federica said, even hewing back to what Louis said, it's, for me, it's not even about fairness. It's about, why would you leave half your chips on the table? Why would you only draw from one part of your society if you're making decisions? There are great ideas everywhere. And as we see in technology, as we see in other fields, you know, when you open it up more to everybody being at the table, you just get better ideas. I mean, it's, for me, it's a pure functional thing. But, you know, when I look at, several billion people in the world where women just don't have the opportunities, cracking that's going to be a tough thing moving forward.
Yeah, I just wanted to... come in on something that I think is a bit of a tendency sometimes when we talk about trying to better ourselves, right? We have pretty ambitious agendas here. We try to make the nuclear field more diverse in terms of gender, race. We also try to diversify it in terms of opinions and backgrounds. And I think that sometimes we have a concern that we're putting ourselves at a disadvantage. We're putting a lot on our own plate, whereas, you know, I'll just say it, countries like China, like Russia, other big stakeholders in the nuclear weapons space, Iran, certainly, they don't burden themselves with these kinds of considerations. And there is the idea that, okay, maybe we need to take a little bit of a break here, and we need to not disadvantage ourselves with so much extra work when we're dealing with competitors and adversaries who don't even think twice about diversity and inclusion. But I would see it from the perspective of we are actually, this isn't necessarily a burden. It's certainly hard work. Change is difficult and it takes time, but I would always try to bring it back to the benefits, to how this is actually going to benefit us in Europe, in all the countries, in all the regions where there is a commitment to diversifying the nuclear weapons space, to be more gender inclusive. And I think one good example of this is how, if we adopted more of a critical, more of a feminist perspective on nuclear weapons, that opens up looking at nuclear weapons or nuclear armament not as a security or a defense question, but it frames it more as a public policy question, and it raises concerns about whether the spending on nuclear weapons as it is today is really the best solution to addressing the problems that our societies face, and how we can improve the lives and security of everyone, not through nuclear armament. And I think that kind of thinking is extremely helpful, because it is exactly the antidote to the sort of instinctive reaction of we need to engage in an arms race. We need to bolster our own capabilities in response.
All right. I think that's a good place to end things. I want to thank you all, especially to Mara, but thanks to Federica and Louis as well for your contribution to the debate today. When we come back with part two, we're going to talk to Mara about her life and times. See you after the break. And we're back with part two of the Arms Control Poser podcast with our guest, Mara Zarka, who is going to tell me a little bit about her life and times. So, Mara, can you tell me, when did you first become interested in arms control, disarmament, and nonproliferation? Were you a nuke nerd as a kid? Did you watch The Day After or something? When did this first really become an issue for you?
Yeah, thank you for the question, William. I was not a nuke nerd as a kid. And I just recently watched The Day After, so that also wasn't the sparking point. But what really made me interested in the field is when I completed an internship at the Preparatory Commission for the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty Organization during my junior year of college. And that internship itself really brought to light what the issues were, the importance of the IAEA and organizations like the CTBTO and what they're trying to achieve. And that's when I kind of had a shift in my educational career path from looking at development issues, international development issues initially, to turning to nuclear. And then I ended up devoting my thesis, my bachelor's thesis, to the topic as well.
Well, okay. So, all right, then we need to back up a little bit and say, where was it that you were going to college for development where a CTBTO internship became possible?
So I went to college at a small liberal arts college in the Pacific Northwest called Lewis and Clark College in Portland, Oregon.
Oh.
And I decided on the majors of international affairs and psychology. And while I was broaching the topic of international affairs, I was taking a lot more of international development courses. And then, like I said, kind of shifted in the latter half of my studies to more the nuclear, more the security side, really.
But again, CTBTO, I mean, you know, it doesn't strike me as something that they just kind of pin up on the, you know, rec room board. Interested, apply here. How did you hear about it?
So I'm part Austrian, and I was looking at opportunities in Austria. And in looking location specific is how I came across the CTBTO.
I see. Wow. So there's a very different world where you ended up on the Wassenaar arrangement or something like that.
Right.
Or OPEC. You could have been an intern at OPEC. And I think
right, exactly.
That would have been a very different life than the one that you
got. Very
so,
trajectory.
Yeah. So then you oriented your bachelor's to that. And then what did you do? Did you go to work right away or did you go get a master's? What happened next?
So what happened next is I was very idealist when I graduated with my bachelor's degree, thinking that there would be jobs waiting for me in the field. That turned out not to be the case. And I didn't have a bank account to support me moving to Washington, D.C. to fully pursue jobs there. So I ended up spending a year back home in Colorado, working in retail, working at various other places, but then I also got engaged in some political campaigns, some local political campaigns. And during this process, I applied for different master's programs and ended up a year later going to the Diplomatic Academy of Vienna to complete a master's.
Wow, that's fantastic. And what did you focus on there at the academy?
So I completed the master's program that is called MISE, which stands for Master of Advanced International Studies. And the way it works is they kind of have four main disciplines, but then you kind of narrow it down and focus on two. So I focused on international affairs and law.
Okay. And so what did you do after that when you graduated?
So after graduating from the Diplomatic Academy, I was looking for jobs and I found the Vienna Center for Disarmament and Nonproliferation, and I've been here ever since.
Wow. Was there anyone really helpful in getting you into the organization?
Not at the time necessarily, because the VCDNP was a fairly new organization at the time I started. They just opened their doors in 2011, and I graduated in 2013 and joined in November 2013. But I did do a previous internship during my master's studies at the International Peace Institute, their Vienna office. And my supervisor there had heard of the organization, was able to inform me of the work they were doing.
Great. But it was just really, you sent in a resume and got an interview and the whole thing. No.
It was really one of those things. There was a job opening, right time, right place, and it ended up being a nice fit.
Wow. Were there any teachers, either for your master's or for your bachelor's program, that really kind of helped you and helped shape your thinking on arms control issues or inspired you to know more and to read
on
more?
On arms control issues per se, not necessarily.
No, but diplomacy writ large or
But yes, I did have some teachers that really inspired me to not only push myself, but also to look into various topics and also to think out of the box. I know my first professor in international affairs, introduction to international affairs, had a very unique style of teaching that was sometimes frustrating, but it also really brought you to consider the topic from different angles. And I think that was really beneficial.
Wow.
So that sparked the interest in the international relations in general. And then I had other professors down the road that taught me the benefits of international organizations and to look at different questions critically.
Well, now I've got to ask, what was the special way of teaching that he had?
It was, so every exam, it was really difficult. Well, it was good to prepare, but it was difficult to prepare. So every exam was, you would have a fictitious scenario.
Yeah.
And you would have to then advise whomever you were to advise, be that the president or a national security advisor, how they should approach this issue, ranging from a variety of topics. This professor also was of the opinion you should always change your seat in the classroom, kind of get out of your habitual context. I should maybe preface this by saying this professor used to work in intelligence, so that might also have sparked a bit of their approach, but I found it really effective. It was really effective for some of us and not so effective for others. It depends on your learning style, I guess.
Wow. That sounds great. So, and has there been anyone in the field for you, either at the Vienna Center for Disarmament and Nonproliferation or other organizations or CTBTO or anything like that, that has acted kind of like as a mentor or a guide or someone who's really helped you or inspired you in the career field?
I would say, so in my time at the Vienna Center for Disarmament and Nonproliferation, I've had two bosses, both Elena Sokova and Laura Rockwood. And both of them have been very supportive and have also served as mentors for me to encourage me to build my expertise and to look at different areas. And also just the close engagement with them has also been highly valuable.
Both total rock stars, as I can attest my own experience. So let me then ask you the final question here. If at any point during your studies or your career, you could go back in time, give yourself some advice on something that would either help you along the way or strengthen you or maybe give you a little bit more hope or energy or direction, what would you say? What point would you go back to yourself and what advice would you want to give?
At which point I would go back, probably just as I embarked on my studies, I would maybe tell myself to not only write for your professors, but also to look at publication opportunities. I think it's something that is intimidating and that's not done as frequently. Maybe it's better now for other people, but having a list of publications under your belt is highly valuable in this field, I've learned. And it's something that I wish I would have been told earlier on and been able to focus on earlier on.
That is absolutely terrific advice. And it's one thing that I still wrestle with. I keep forgetting that, you know, having worked in government for such a long time, you can also actually publish things. And we live in an era now where there are so many places, especially for younger folk, a lot of journals, a lot of groups that are looking for younger people to write on topics, including the European Union Nonproliferation and Disarmament Consortium itself, which welcomes ideas from young scholars who want to publish in this field. And I would encourage you to reach out to them. Have you published anything for the UNPDC?
I have, and I'm really glad that you mentioned that. I was fortunate to publish one of the policy papers with a colleague of mine, as well as publish something in their newsletter, which I can just mention the newsletter is a good way to just get kind of a small piece out there if someone just kind of wants to test the waters as well.
Well, that wraps it up. Thank you very much, Amara, for your time today. Thank you for telling me about your life and times, and thank you for telling me, also educating me and hopefully our audience as well, a little bit on women, peace, and security. All right, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much, William.
I repeat again. I repeat again. I repeat again. I repeat again. I repeat again.